You're listening to highlights from the Creative Process and One Planet podcast interview with Dr. Paul Srivastava, co-president of the Club of Rome and professor of management and organizations at Pennsylvania State University. This podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation.
The Club of Rome is actually a think tank which was established in late 1960s by Aurelio Pace, who was at that time the CEO of Fiat, an automobile company in Italy. And his idea was that there were a lot of people thinking about big challenges, global challenges, but the one area that was missing is some kind of long-term thinking on the prospects of humanity surviving in the long run. So he put together this group, and they took on what they call the human problematique, by which they referred to the idea of how do humans survive through both the technological as well as ecological, economic challenges that are forthcoming back in the 1960s. And he designed it as a think tank rather than as a consulting company or as a research company. So it was supposed to be independent. Over the 6 years, it has morphed and transformed, particularly in the last 5 years, huge transformation. The method that we have adopted is one of systems analysis. So systemic thinking, how do we change and transform large-scale planetary systems? We are living with an extractive mindset where we are extracting one way out of the life system of the Earth. And we need to change from that mindset to a regenerative mindset. We need to change from the North Star of economic growth to a vision of eco-civilizations. The two main principles that I want to propose and that the Club of Rome suggests that we try to transform our current organization towards regenerative living and eco-civilization. So regenerative living means that the system that sustains us, we need to give back to it. We can't just one way extract out of it, whether it is fossil fuels, which you pointed out, or agriculture. Just extracting out of the earth without sustaining the soil is not a way that we can live for the long run. So for us, regenerativity or regenesis, it can be applied in many areas. There's already a big community of regenerative agriculture. There is regenerative medicine, where people are thinking of regenerating at the cell level for health. There is even talk about regenerative economies, circular economies, and regenerative finance. But it's not just a question of knowledge. It's also a question of values and mindsets. We need transformation at many scales. The world is not some kind of abstract economic growth utopia where everybody has a certain level of income, but a place where the earth systems are in balance, they are healthy, and they're supporting life. So we call this eco-civilization with the idea that we want to see an integrated development of humans and nature in a kind of mutual harmony and balance with each other. The inequalities that have been created over the last 100 years have distorted even the principles of capitalism as it was originally conceived. Capitalism is not one thing. It has been around for 500 years. And over that time, you and I and the public have given it certain rights to do certain things in certain ways. They're all legal rights, but they've just accumulated them to a point that in the United States, a corporation is a person, and a person who has more rights than all the human rights that we have. So it is in our interest and it is our responsibility to reshape the rules of capitalism and to make sure that it both reduces the extreme inequalities as well as allows the development of a healthy planet. Can that be done? Are there good ideas for doing it? My answer to that is yes. In the last 50 to 75 years, we have learned so much about the nature of what's going on to Earth systems as a whole, whether they're mountains or forests or oceans or land masses. So we have tremendous amount of scientific knowledge. We have also a political understanding of the downsides of this extreme inequality. The current system benefits some people, privileges some ideas, and it's taken 500 years to evolve. It's not going to change in the next year or two or five or 10. It's a transformation process that we need to put into place. This has to be done in a collaborative way. And if we put an antagonistic lens that it is billionaires versus the poor, we are not likely to find a solution that easily. So we look for something in which each party can respectfully understand each other's positions and move towards that optimum solution that will be good for all. And so while the economic wealth production system is broken, I think our political system is also broken. I mean, we allow this kind of money politics to prevail. We make laws for this kind of flawed democracy to emerge. And we need to fix that also. How do we fix it? These risks rising to the level of what I call existential risks. They threaten the human survival, the human imaginary in the current form. And the response to it needs to be in the form of existential opportunities. It can't be just transforming a small piece here and a small piece there, whether it is the definition of democracy or the finance influencing democracy. We need to rethink what it means to be human in the Anthropocene. The Anthropocene poses many, many challenges, ecosystem challenges, social polycrisis, all of that. A word or two about AI. I think AI is sort of inevitable in some ways. It is not very I right now. It's not very intelligent. It is probably AS, which is artificial stupidity. But it's a question of time before it becomes smarter and smarter. And we need to tackle the right use question and the value question now as it is developing. And it can put on steroids and it can amplify both the positive possibilities as well as the negative consequences. And we want to make sure that it is benefiting the largest number of people on Earth and Earth systems themselves. Not only is it an intergenerational question, but this tendency for the techno-industrial shiny object to dominate is even suppressing our own humanness. So humans absorb knowledge in many ways. It's not just an intellectual cognitive thing. We have emotional knowledge and we have social knowledge and we have traditional knowledge systems and we have faith-based knowledge. What these techno-industrial knowledge systems are doing is suppressing all of those. So we don't trust our own emotions. We are asked to actually doubt our emotion. We are actually asked to leave our subjectivity. And we call this science and we call it progress. So we need to be a little bit more thoughtful about what constitutes knowledge and wisdom. And much of this wisdom comes from our bodies. Much of it comes from nature that we interact with on a day-to-day basis. Not some abstract concept of rainforest or oceans, but from the moment you walk out and experience a form of knowledge through your own perceptions. And we have learned to devalue it. This is, I think, short-sighted. It ultimately transforms us into automatons of some sort, and we need to be guarded against it. I think it's a kind of evolution of consciousness that we need to experience. Not everybody is there, but I think being human allows us the ability to draw and to grow. And I feel that that is what I'm trying to argue for when I talk about embodied learning. Use your body to learn, or emotional learning, learning with passion about nature or about people or about communities. So I think what I'm trying to point out is the potential of what it means to be human in the future. Some of our humanity is going to be dominated by technology. There is no question about it. I mean, we benefit by prosthetic devices. You are wearing glasses. I'm wearing hearing aids. I'm wearing a heart valve. By the time you reach my age, you've got many of these technological enhancements, if you will. But we can't be just seduced by that. It has to play a role in the bigger meaning seeking that we are engaged in. What is it that is meaningful for humans? What is the purpose of our lives? We need to be rethinking that and give place to technology and economics, etc. But realize that we are part of that bigger consciousness that is unifying. It almost sounds somewhat spiritual. I mean, each of these words comes with a lot of baggage with it. So I want to be careful that people who are listening to this podcast don't misinterpret that. Science is very important. Technology is very important. Economics is important, but it's not the whole thing. The big system, each one of us has to manifest for ourselves. And it depends to some degree on our own skills, our cognitive, our emotional, our spiritual skills. And each of us will reach it to a different level. That is the eco-civilization future I'm imagining. A lot of it also needs to be fleshed out. There's not a single ecological future or a single eco-civilization out there. There are probably many of them. We need to design our own lives and our livelihoods to meet our eco-civilizational future. I do remember a few things about my upbringing that I think helped shape my systems view. And so on the one hand, Hinduism, which is a multi-god religion, and they have an understanding of cosmology that is multi-lifetime. You don't end your life in this one. You kind of reincarnate your soul into another one. So they have this big cosmological picture, which is what created a sense of wonder and awe in me right from childhood. Like, oh my God, we are not just living in this house, in this neighborhood, in this town, in this country, in this world. There is this whole big thing with time and space. So it kind of unbounded my physical existence. On the other hand, the same precepts of religion and caste system within the Hindu religion was another mind opener. Like, we are imposing these rules, systemic rules, on our own lives, which are privileging some people, privileging some ideas, and denouncing other people and ideas. And so I was keenly perceptive that systems analysis broadly lacks a kind of self-reflectivity about its own boundaries. It doesn't allow non-material things, spiritual things, to enter. And to some degree, the club of Rome's work also suffers from that. We do a lot of systems analysis of material systems, but don't incorporate the spiritual, the emotional, the subjective as strongly into it, the artistic, the aesthetic, etc. And one of my goals now at the Club of Rome is to open up the dialogue to include these human systems that are in many ways driving what's happening to the earth systems. I would love to have an educational system that allowed children to retain that sense of wonder and that emotionality that makes them children. And in our hurry to grow up and become rational, because rational gets rewarded by a rational economy, we have distorted many parts of being human, and we systematically keep on suppressing and distorting it. So it might be that at some point, at least some humans will realize the power and the utility of being emotional and being more natural to who they are and embracing nature in more naturalistic ways than we currently do through our socialized ideas about what nature is and what we can do with it. Because the socialized ideas are the ones that are making nature into an asset. And then you put a price on it. And you forget that it's also a tree. I think we are the final authors of our life. And if we look at the ordinary things, we can make them extraordinary just by our sheer will and experiencing them in a different way. I see people changing their livelihoods and changing their communities in order to maintain that integrity of what they want to do in these small, ordinary things. The promise of technology and the promise of this industrial shining object is deeply flawed. It does not include a vision of trying to bring in that humanness, the compassion, the connection between people and between people and animals. And I have seen the hollowing of urban life from animals over the last 70 years that I think is hugely detrimental to humans. Humans are a kind of animal, and we have lived in harmony with animals for the longest time, not in a subjugating animals way, not just like killing 80 billion animals for our food, which to me is not just morally wrong. It's incomprehensible that we do it. I can't understand this because I've had a relationship with animals that has been much more of an equal nature. I feel that everything that I learn about emotions actually is from my dog. How to rely on other people, how to trust other people, those emotions are common to animals. I feel that all this knowledge that I've accumulated over 20 years in colleges and universities and working in those environments has diminished my own humanity.
We hope you've enjoyed this program and listening to the highlights of this podcast. If you'd like to get involved in One Planet Podcast or learn more about environmental projects, click on the subscribe button. Thank you for listening.